Hello and welcome to the Chicago Songwriter Podcast, Episode 5. Today I have James Curley. How you doing, James?
I'm excellent.
Thanks, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's a very cool thing that you're doing.
Thank you very much. I'm glad that you were able to come in and join us today. It's a beautiful day out there.
Yeah, I'd rather be outside on the deck at home sipping an adult beverage. But
there you go.
No, this is fun too. So
very nice. Do you spend a lot of time outside playing guitar and stuff?
Do, actually. We have a deck in the back of our house on the second floor.
Oh, nice.
And just take the guitar out lots of summer nights and just play.
I love playing outside.
I do too. And Chicago, very rare, you know, number of days in a year that you can do that. So
campfires are great. Have you ever played by a campfire?
I have many times. When I was a younger person, well, yesterday was my 28th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
So I'm older than I look and feel as old as I am. But when I was younger, I went to Kerrville a lot, the Kerrville Folk Festival, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, many times.
Yeah.
And a lot of campfires in those events. Kerrville is an amazing place, and I miss it. I haven't been back in about 10 or 11 years, but it's a great, great environment for that. The parking lot and the campfire scene, and the Philadelphia Folk Festival, of course, is legendary.
So does it go late into the night?
Oh, God, yes. All night.
Yeah, all night.
All night.
Till the sun comes up?
When it, you know, sometimes, and you can come and go as you please, and I'd say about 3 in the morning it really starts to, you got to be hardcore after about 3 in the morning.
Your fingers start to get tired around 3, huh?
Yeah, and the good acts don't really start coming on until 11 in the morning or even later, because early morning there's a lot of workshops and things that are not performances. So, you know, you can crash till noon and still catch everybody you want to see, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So one of the things we like to talk about early on is just to get to know songwriter a little bit. And I was looking at your website and see that you spent some time in Philadelphia, in Texas, Colorado, Illinois. So how did you find your way from Philadelphia to all these other places?
Born and raised in Philadelphia in a neighborhood called Gray's Ferry, which was one time written up in Life magazine as the most racist community in the United States.
Oh, geez.
And so when I was a young guy, very young, you know, 10, 12 years old, we were the site of some very serious race riots, a lot of violence, and the neighborhood was lower middle class, Irish, Catholic, working class, whatever you want to call it. And we had all of the problems that inner cities were having at the time. We were having white flight, and we were having race riots, and we were having the influx of a lot of hard drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, fortunately avoided much of that, but at the age of 17, decided I had to leave Philadelphia, and went to college in Philadelphia, and decided that wasn't far enough to get out of Grace Ferry. I had to get out of Philadelphia, so I left and went to Colorado, and lived in Boulder and Denver for a while. I kind of followed at the time. I was a big fan of Dan Fogelberg's.
Uh-huh.
And, Dan Fogelberg had a studio up in the mountains just outside Boulder, called Nederland Ranch in Nederland, Colorado. And I had the notion that I was going to go there and meet him. And when I got out there, decided that it didn't matter, that it was just so beautiful in Boulder, that if he showed up in a restaurant or something, I'd say hi. But I had no interest in going and knocking on his door and saying, hey, I'm this crazy, insane fan who likes to write songs too, and would you please let me in? So, but it was my sort of fantasy impetus for getting out of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Wound up living there, and my brother, Michael, who's a musician and performer, though not a songwriter, at the time, his way out of South Philadelphia was to join the Merchant Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was shipping around the world, and he was at one point shipping out of Port of Houston on oil tankers. And he had an apartment in Houston, and he said, you know, I'm going away for 6 months to the Gulf of Suez and all this stuff. Would you come and watch my apartment? And I thought, well, haven't been to Texas yet. Went down to Texas, and I was kind of still going to school at different places, so I was getting this like really motley college career. So I wound up in Houston and living in the Westheimer district of Houston, and it was a hotbed of music at the time. Texas songwriter scene was tremendous, and actually one of my favorite songwriters is somebody virtually no one's heard of, a guy named Shake Russell. And I'm a huge Shake Russell fan. I think he's a great, great Texas songwriter. And I started going to clubs, and at the time, Shake Russell had a band, the Shake Russell Band, and he was playing, and I got deeply into the Texas songwriter scene in Houston, and that's how I started going to Kerrville, and eventually I met my wife, who, you know, yesterday we were married 28 years. She was from Chicago and left Chicago to travel to Texas just to get out of Chicago and see the world and that kind of stuff. And so she and I decided to get married 4 months after we met each other, and decided to, instead of having a honeymoon, we would pack up the apartment and move to Austin.
Ah, yeah.
So we left Houston literally a day or two after we got married, and us and my best man, who was also a bass player that I was working with, named Mark Allen Williams, who is to this day a very, very in-demand bass player in Austin for sessions and things like that. We wound up living in Austin and playing music in Austin, and obviously the Houston scene, which was robust, compared nothing to Austin.
Oh, yeah.
And Austin, at the time, wasn't quite the blues capital or rock and roll capital that it became later. Mm-hmm. It was a much more acoustic kind of town at the time. And Towns Van Zandt and the Armadillo World Headquarters.
Yeah.
I saw guys...
I've been to the Armadillo World Headquarters.
Yeah, it's a legendary and, you know, sadly defunct place. Like many places of my growing up years, Grendel's Lair in Philadelphia, the main point in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. Anyway... started going to the Armadillo World Headquarters. I'll never forget a show my wife and I saw on one of our first dates, which was Steve Goodman, Leon Redbone, and the Roaches, if you know who the Roaches are, this trio of sisters. Tremendous show. But I saw Joe Ely there for the first time, a very young Joe Ely.
Yeah.
And all kinds of people. I mean, all kinds of... saw Lloyd Maines, whose daughter went on to become Natalie Maines.
Yeah.
The Dixie Chicks. And, you know, lots of people. Saw Ry Cooder and... eventually followed Ry Cooder's path and wound up on John Hyatt, who's one of my favorite songwriters. And so the Texas thing was big. And then my wife's from a very large Chicago family. She's one of 13 kids, and it's kind of a very extended clan. And she got, I think, homesick and family sick more than homesick. Because mm-hmm. Chicago's kind of brutal, as you know, weather-wise, compared to Austin. But, you know, she missed her family, and I really had no intention of going back to Philadelphia. So she said, let's try Chicago. We came up here, and... I have to say, as soon as I moved to Chicago, absolutely loved the city. Reminded me of everything I liked about Philadelphia with not much of the things I didn't like.
Yeah.
And moved originally into the suburbs, but eventually within a year moved into the city, lived in Rogers Park, and we're still in Rogers Park to this day.
Great.
So, I love Chicago. I think it's a world-class city.
So your travel out to meet Dan Fogelberg... sounds a little bit like Bob Dylan going out to meet Woody Guthrie in New Jersey.
Yeah, not unlike. I mean, it was one of those things that... Hello? Hey, this is real time, baby.
It is real time and embarrassing, too.
Hey, you know, there's nothing embarrassing about people calling you.
That's right.
It's what they say.
So, I mean, you hear that story about Bob Dylan going out there to meet Woody Guthrie, and so you kind of had your own little trip out there to meet Dan Fogelberg. Did you ever meet him?
No. And, you know, in some ways, I think we all mythologize our past, because it's much more interesting to mythologize your past than it is to just view it coldly. And whether or not Bob Dylan left Hibbing, Minnesota to meet Woody Guthrie, or whether later on he said, I wanted to meet Woody Guthrie... I mean, I had one of those things in mind, but the truth was, the real impetus was I had to just see what was outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
It was a very, very intense inner city environment, and the difference between row homes in South Philadelphia, 56 row homes to a side of a street, two of those to the block, four of those to the square block, and Boulder, Colorado, where you literally could walk into the hills, was mind-blowing to me. And really, that's why I went.
Yeah.
That's why when I got there, I had no interest in tracking down Dan.
Just beautiful there.
It was unbelievable, and still is. I have a business on my day job in Boulder, and it's still a great place to go.
So now, were you a songwriter at that time? Did you write songs in Philly?
Yeah, I was. I actually wrote songs starting when I was about 13. First of all, I come from a very musical family. My father was a great, great singer. He had a wonderful tenor voice. He was what's called a wingman or an interlocutor in the minstrel shows, which are, you know, we look back on minstrel shows as racist, and rightly so. I mean, they were the blackface, and they were clearly, you know, disparaging to African Americans. But I know my dad, and I know it wasn't his intention. You know, he grew up listening to Al Jolson and that stuff, and that was pretty much the music of his day. And so... My father sang in the minstrel shows, and he also sang in the church choir, and he was featured every year on the radio in Philadelphia because our church choir, my father being one of the better singers, but they had tremendous voices in our choir, a lot of Irish tenors.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had a great voice, and he played piano and he played accordion, and every party at our house had live music, every party.
Nice.
Growing up. And we were Irish, so there were a lot of parties.
Yeah.
And so my three brothers, two of them are musicians. My oldest brother, Jack's also a songwriter. My brother Michael's a great, great front man for a band, and I, you know, I'm a songwriter. So I started writing early. You know, I mean, I don't know what to say. I was born in 57, so by the time I was 7 years old, I was hearing the Beatles and all that stuff. And it was just lots of stuff going on musically. My brother Jack, who's 5 years older than me, was bringing home lots of great records. And my father had great records. My father had tremendous American show tunes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American Musical Theater stuff, which is, to this day, the melodies of those things just intrigue me. And my daughter, she's a curly all the way through. She's her favorite, you know, show is Guys and Dolls.
Yeah.
And she just loves the music in that, as I do. And, I mean, I remember when... You know, I just got the movie with Marlon Brando, who I never thought was right for the role. But that's another story.
Yeah.
You know, and she loved it, and she's, you know, hopes to perform in it someday. We had a great – I went to a large inner-city Catholic high school. It was all boys, and we had a sister school down the road, and there was 2,000 boys in our school and over 2,000 girls in high school, girls' high school down the road. And we had major, major theatrical productions. We had Fiorello and Guys and Dolls when I was there, and Camelot.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those melodies influenced me, my father's records. My father had jazz records, and by jazz, I mean more like swing.
Yeah.
He had a huge swing collection. He was a big fan of not only the big bands, but the jazz singers.
Mm-hmm.
And including the early jazz singers, Al Jolson. My father was a huge Louis Armstrong fan, so
he
had a lot of Louis Armstrong. So constant rhythm and melody and lyrical content in my house growing up. And then, of course, we inserted the Beatles. And I'll never forget the day, you know, that my father was just sitting around and we were listening to records, and he just said, "Boy, those Beatles, they can write some songs." And it was that moment where I connected the one generation to the other, where, you know, I thought of the Beatles as my music.
Yeah.
And realized that my father was hearing it in a different way, but he was hearing the brilliance of those melodies and those rhythms and those chord structures. And, you know, my father, you know, I remember before he died telling me he thought Yesterday was the best song he'd ever heard.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing if you think about it. You
yeah.
know? So, you know, started writing at 13. Virtually nothing remains.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
I do.
What was it about?
Oh, no.
A girl?
Yes, a girl.
Yeah.
Yes. It was horrible. God, you know, I'm not even, what do you want me to say?
Did you play it for her?
No.
No.
No. I played it for everybody but her. It was, you know, trite.
Yeah.
As songs of 13-year-olds tend to be. But on the other hand, it didn't stop me from trying to write more songs. And only one song from my very early songwriting survived all these years. And when I was 17, I wrote a song about my neighborhood called Tom's Cafe. And that song...
You wrote that when you were 17?
I wrote it when I was 17. Now, the way I wrote it when I was 17 is distinctly different than the way it is now, because we'll talk about this, I guess, in songwriting process, but in my mind, a song is never finished.
Sure.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you can continue to edit songs for rhythm and for lyrics per metric feet and things that are more technical and more craft-oriented, which I learned later on. So when I wrote the song, you know, I was... 17, I had already been twice to the Philadelphia Folk Festival, and I had seen at the time, 1975, I believe, a guy named Ralph McTell, if you've ever heard Ralph McTell, British
No.
songwriter, had a huge hit on American radio called Streets of London, which, you know, have you seen the old man outside the Seaman's Mission? You know, it was a classic sort of folk song. It was a huge hit in Philadelphia, at least. I don't know about the rest of the country. And I was deeply moved by Streets of London, deeply moved by Ralph McTell's songwriter style and his voice. And he was one of my big early influences. I ran out and bought every Ralph McTell record there was, which at the time was three or four, because he had been playing in Britain since the late 60s or mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom's Cafe really ripped off Streets of London. I mean, it just was a classic, you know, early songwriter phase where, you know, you haven't crafted your own melody lines yet, and you haven't really understood the process of crafting melody and crafting lyric into metric feet and things like that. But the sentiment of the song was important to me because it was about a building on Gray's Ferry Road in the neighborhood of Gray's Ferry that I grew up in, which was there for a long time, and my uncles and my father and relatives and friends and parishioners that we knew all grew up with as adults going there to drink and to have a good time. It was not a bar. It wasn't just like a tap with hard-boiled eggs on the counter. It was a place where people would eat and have dinner, and it was across the street from something called the AOH, which probably no one's ever heard of anymore, but AOH stood for the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
Oh.
And it was the Irish version of the Knights of Columbus.
Okay.
And my father was a member of the AOH post, I want to say 47, I can't remember now, but and we all marched in the St. Patrick's Day parade every year with the AOH. I drove by the building, and it was literally falling apart, and it was covered with weeds, and I just somehow was moved to write a song about that, and I wrote that song, and then it survived. And then years later, when I was getting ready to do the record in 2002, I rewrote the song.
Uh-huh.
And rewrote it relatively severely, so that when my youngest brother first heard it, he got a little mad at me because it was not the song he remembered. I changed quite a bit of the lyrics, but to me, again, the difference between the inspiration for the song remaining true and remaining real, and then the execution of the song as a more mature artist. You know, fortunately, I didn't record it when I was 17 and didn't have that to live down to.
Right.
But at the same time, my family loved the song and thinks highly of it and have adapted to the more mature version of it. But, that's the only song that survived that early period, frankly.
Yeah, it's a great arrangement. I was listening to that earlier.
Thanks.
And the accordion and just it sounds great. I mean, it's a perfect arrangement, I think, for the piece.
Yeah, you know, and given that it's available for listen on the internet and stuff, I wasn't sure if I should play it tonight. I was kind of preparing not to play it, but I think I may.
Okay, sure.
Because I haven't played it in a while.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean,
and I'll have to go to drop D here.
Okay. Now, do you do a lot of stuff in alternate tunings?
Not a lot, but some. I like drop D a lot, and I actually have a dadgad version of, actually maybe I'll do that with a partial capo. The dadgad version of it is to me interesting because it's almost more Irish in a way, because a lot of the Celtic music has a dadgad.
So were you influenced by a lot of Irish music growing up?
I was, certainly. I mean, and our Irish music was the sort of, there was only two types. There was the really sappy, is your mother from Ireland?
The Americanized Irish.
The Irish sappy stuff.
Okay.
The stuff like, my parents, my grandmother was born and raised in Ireland.
Yeah.
And I actually, several of my grandparents were born and raised in Ireland. So we had a very direct connection, and we still had relatives there and stuff. And so most of the Irish songs were either the sappy, how much they missed Ireland, or
yeah,
was your mother from Ireland, or all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then we also had, which I found more interesting, the militant sort of Irish stuff, which was, and Paddy dear, and did you hear the news that's going round? The shamrock is forbid by law to grow on Irish ground, and St. Patrick's Day no more his holy colour will be seen. They're hanging men and women for the wearing of the green. I mean, that was a big deal.
More of the rebel type song.
Yeah, because, my grandmother, who was a rosary-playing contemplative mystic, as well as a very funny and lively woman, once said, God loves all creatures except the English. So there was that piece of the Irish thing for me. So, I was heavily influenced by that. And I, to this day, still consider myself quite Irish, actually.
Great.
So should we do this now?
Yeah.
All right, this is the dadgad version, and I'm hoping I don't flub it because I haven't played it in a while. But, the day they closed Tom's Cafe,
all the neighbors sighed. Mr. Shannon said, Tom's dead 5 years, better he's not alive. His brother ran the place till the area ran down. Now time was up, closed it up, and he moved away from town. Cafe sat by railroad tracks and was busy all the time, serving engineers and brakemen from the Pennsylvania line. Houses sprung up around it, Tom made many friends. Business grew, he made a woman's lounge, kept the front door for. The old cafe by the railroad tracks, and the factory that turned the river black, stand naked, having hid from the wrecking crew. It seems like yesterday when I heard Irish jigs coming from Tom's Cafe. My grandfather was a friend of Tam's. Went there many nights after working in the factory from dawn through twilight. I can see the cinematic Pat O'Brien scene. St. Patrick's Day was a sight, oh, the wearing of the green. Their lives were formed before I was born. I only sense remains. I hear every shattered memory, many joys, every pain. And the neighborhood has now declined, and the factory's obsolete. Skeletons of buildings now define Grace Ferry Street. The old cafe by the railroad track, and the factory that turned the river black, stand naked, having hid from the wrecking crew. It seems like yesterday I'd heard Irish jigs coming from Tom's Cafe. Drove past the cafe recently and spied the sober scene. Rubble cluttered vacant lots and sidewalks sprouted weeds. And there's a brand new factory that burns its waste, so sulfur scents the air. Under the overpass of a new highway, the cafe standing. The old cafe by the railroad track, and the factory that turned the river black, stand naked, having hid from the wrecking crew. It seems like yesterday I heard Irish jigs coming from Tom's Cafe.
Very nice.
Well, I blew that first modal B minor, but actually it's a C sharp minor. But
that sounded great.
What are you going to do? Thanks.
Hey. So
well, now I have my 17 years old. The way.
There you go.
Yeah.
17 years old.
Well, it's interesting because I'm looking at the lyric from then, which I just used to sort of spell me on it, but I wasn't actually reading it because it's different. So, you know, it's my grandfather was a friend of Tom's, and he went there many a night. Any night, you know, I realize this is stupid and archaic construction, you know. But, you know, at the time. And then I said he would drink his ales and sing Irish songs. "Twas a Pat O'Brien scene." And, you know, when I look back, it's like, it's not going to work either. Because those are, you know, affectations that are not the way I speak. And as I became a better songwriter and took some songwriting courses and read Jimmy Webb's book, which is a Bible, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Realized, you know, you don't need to many a night or twas anything.
So did those lyrics, how did they switch? Did you rewrite those whole lines, or did you tweak them? Or how do they sound today in the lines today versus what they were then?
Yeah, I tweaked them a lot. Rhythmically, the song's quite different.
Yeah.
Because it was much more of a 1-2-3 finger pick piece when I was 17, because I was just learning how to finger pick.
And yeah.
I didn't have a style, which I think now I do,
uh-huh.
as a finger stylist. So when I realized that I was playing it on guitar, instead of playing it, now, you know, I'll just try the sort of 1-2-3, because I wrote it in C back when I was 17, and it was like, you know. It was Streets of London. I ripped it off. So, and I'm conscious of the fact that I ripped it off, but at the time I felt like it was homage to Ralph McCall. But, you know, so when I went to rewrite the lyric, having, you know, taken some classes and just gotten better in analyzing songs I liked and being a more mature writer of both lyrics and music, basically I wrote out the metric feet to the way I was finger picking it. And then reworked the lyric into the metric feet. And then, obviously, there were lines that had too many words for the metric feet and also weren't saying things I wanted to say anymore. So when I edit songs, I edit them multiple times. My method is usually to write, even now when I write a song, this is obviously something written when I was 17, but even now when I write a song and I literally put it like a kimchi jar in the ground and I just let it stew, ferment mm-hmm. for a bit. And then I take it out a couple of weeks later because I don't want to be in the headspace I was in when I started writing it, because inspiration is a poor guide to art, in my opinion. It's a great place to start, but it's a bad place to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take out the piece and then I look at it from a technical aspect. And does it work rhythmically? Am I actually saying what it is I wanted to say? Because sometimes in the midst of inspiration, like all writing, you know, things come flying out.
Sure.
And then you realize that in the ears of another listener, they're ridiculous. They don't make sense, or they're archaic instructions, or whatever they are. And so then I start to work from a critical self-editing standpoint. A, am I saying what it is I want to say lyrically? B, are the lyrics actually fitting the metric feet of the song? Am I creating places where the listener is going to go, I don't like that.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, there's a long process for me to finish a song. Most songs of mine don't come out to the public until months and sometimes years after I've started writing them.
Wow.
Because that's how art is. I mean, I don't want to see, you know, great artist drafts of their paintings.
You know, I want to see the finished thing. Yeah.
And I don't want to see the movie before it's edited and put on the screen.
Right.
I don't want to be in the cutting room. I want to see the finished movie. That's what I'm paying my money for.
That's right.
And so I feel as an artist and a songwriter that when I play a song for people, whether it's for money or not, which is irrelevant to me,
right,
that you're sharing something with them that should be finished. Mm-hmm. No different than, you know, you bring them over for dinner and you don't serve them half a meal. You say, well, you never got around the other half.
Right.
You know. So just, to me, common courtesy dictates that you give them a finished song. And for me, when I was much younger, in my 20s, I didn't know what a finished song felt like or sounded like, and mm-hmm. now I do.
Yeah.
And that's a very important distinction, I think, as a songwriter, is to know if you feel that the song's unfinished, it's unfinished.
So can you articulate what it is that makes it feel finished, or are there clues, or is it just a feeling that you have?
No, there are clues, I
yeah.
think. I think the song, first of all, it works on multiple levels. It works rhythmically. It works lyrically. It's cohesive. It's concise. I think being concise is very important in a lyric.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, Tom's Cafe is probably the least concise lyric I have. And I try now to write. I literally will sometimes do an exercise where I'll take a song and remove all the prepositions. And remove all the modifiers and just see what's there in terms of subjects and verbs.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes you're tempted to say and too many times,
yeah,
or the too many times,
right,
where it's unnecessary.
Uh-huh.
And so for me, a finished song somehow is it's concise as a lyric, and it's precise as a rhythmic and melodic piece. So concise and precise. That doesn't mean it's surgical or cold. Mm-hmm. It just means it works. There's no fumbly places in it, I guess I would call it. You know, there's no clumsiness to it. And that doesn't mean, like, you can write a complex meter, or you can write a simple meter, a 4-4 meter, or I actually have one Mexican waltz that I've written, which I love, called Our Lady of Rogers Park. And actually I wrote that song, and I took it, and when I thought it was finished, took it to a friend of mine, Nancy Walker, who's used to be in the Sons of the Never Wrong, and she's I think Nancy's a very gifted songwriter and great singer. And she listened to it, and she said, "I like the song, James, it's a verse too long." And I had that reaction of like, no, it's not. I'm saying everything I want to say. And then she said, "Yeah, but you're actually saying too much." And she said, "You know, the third verse is unnecessary." And I looked at it, and I realized she was dead right. That the third verse was, there was nothing the third verse added to the lyric or to the song that the other three verses didn't, you know, the first, second, and fourth verse didn't show. And it really was superfluous. And so I thought, well, you never stop learning. You know, I mean, to me it was a finished song. But the neat thing is, when I took the verse out, the rest of the song was finished. There was no other lyrical changes.
Okay.
Or another. So it was too long, but it was concise and precise in its way.
Just a little pruning, huh?
It was 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
So we had to, you know, the other thing about a song is, you know, I think we've all been conditioned by pop culture ADD that songs are 3.5 to 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I'm conditioned to the days when records were 38 to 41 minutes.
Yeah.
And
the whole album.
My next record, which is coming out very soon, is 9 songs and 38 minutes. And I might add a 10th song. But beyond that, I think you lose people.
Yeah.
People don't want to listen to a record for 13, 14, 15 tracks, an hour and 10 minutes, an hour and 20 minutes. And so I'm trying to make the songs concise and make the record concise. And, you know, songs are finished when they're finished, but I know how it feels now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have a standard for it, which I didn't have when I was younger.
You mentioned the Beatles earlier, and it's amazing how great their songs are. And you go back, and some of them are 2 minutes and 20 seconds, or, you know, 90% of them are under 3 minutes.
2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable.
And yet they sound perfectly complete, and you don't feel like, well, you know, that was too fast.
Well, you know, I recorded a Steve Joyner song on my next record called Never Been to Memphis.
Yeah.
And I'll let Steve play that sometime if he comes here. But
he's one of the future guests.
Oh,
so.
Good. Well, I happen to think, I wrote Steve a note after I recorded the song, and I said to him, I thought it was a perfect song.
Yeah.
It's concise, although I played a little bit with the preposition part of the lyric, but the basic song was concise. It gets to the chorus quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a bridge, and all that takes place. I mean, we added some horns and played it out on the record and had some fun with it in a sort of a Memphis Stax style. But the song itself, as written, is just over 3 minutes. And to me, it was like all this stuff was said in 3 minutes. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to record it, because I thought it was a really good song. And I only heard Steve play it once in the songwriting circle at Old Town, which is, by the way, one of two times I ever got to songwriting circle, because it always seems to fall on a Friday night when I'm either just coming back from out of town and I'm racked, or I'm going out of town for a trade show or something, so, or a gig or whatever. So it's I'll get there again. But
yeah, we'd love to see you show up again. He played the CD, your version.
Oh,
of it.
Great!
It sounded great.
Yeah, we had some fun with it.
Yeah,
it's a kind of slow, funky.
Yeah, it had a nice kind of Memphis groove, like you're talking
about.
Yeah,
well, this record is very much a band record, and my next record is going to be very acoustic. I think just me and a stand-up bass and a mandolin and maybe one other instrument.
So I was going to ask you, the cuts that I listened to today, which I believe are off your upcoming CD out there on the internet.
Yeah.
It sounded like they were written for a band. And I was going to ask you, do you write for a band or do you write for yourself? I think more than any of the other people I've had on here so far, all of those just felt like band songs and not solo guitar sing songs.
Singer, strum writer,
yeah,
songs.
Yeah, there you go.
As I say.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things. One is, first of all, there's no feeling like fronting a band.
Uh-huh.
whatever that is, there is, and there's no greater honor that other musicians do you than by saying they want to play your music and they want to write their own piano or bass or drum parts to your music. And so I have been fortunate on and off over the years to have worked with musicians who want to play my music. And so I think sometimes like a band.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing about it is, I think, you know, the great songwriters from Broadway, from Tin Pan Alley, from even, you know, Motown and you know, from the Brill Building in the 60s, you know, Carole King and Jerry Goffin and those guys. None of those people wrote those songs with the intention that those songs be played with one guitar and one voice.
Right.
Or one piano and one voice. And so I think, you know, a song has a life of its own once it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And I finish a song and, you know, I could play that song by myself on guitar, but at the end of the day, I know in my head that that song is unfinished until it's arranged for multiple instrumentation. And the classic instrumentation for a guy of my generation, of course, is drums, bass, two guitars, and piano or whatever,
sure,
a couple voices. But you'll notice on my record that there are other instruments. There's horns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the new record has three tracks with horn sections and Hammond B3s, which I love the sound of a Hammond B3 and always have. So I think songs need arrangement in order for the full expression of the song to take place.
Now, do you do the arrangements?
I participate in the arrangements with most of the arrangements are done with Larry Kleiman, who is my producer. Larry is first of all, a very gifted guitarist. His first, you know, claim to fame is as a really good guitarist. He was musical director for Lonnie Mack in the Lonnie Mack Blues Band years ago. He had a band called Big Shoulders and was the guitarist in a band called the Otters, who used to hold legendary Tuesday night sets at Shuba's in the early 90s. Larry is married to Nancy Walker, my friend, and I produce my work at his home studio in Saratoga Springs, New York, and it's we do them together. But I will say that, you know, when I did this record, I sent Larry basically, this is what I want. I want this songs. I want horns. I want a Memphis style horns. This other song, I want horns, but it's got to be Mexican mariachi. This song, I want this more acoustic, more electric, less electric. So yeah, I don't arrange them in the sense that I'm writing charts.
You have the idea of the sound,
absolutely.
You know, what you want it to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I also took songs that I knew would work with roughly the same instrumentation, especially a rhythm section, and put them on this record. So this record is themed, both musically and lyrically. The lyrics are all about meaning, and it's really, this record is a meditation on post-9/11 and post-Katrina America.
Yeah.
And the title of the record is called Manufactured Meaning, and it comes from Poet Laureate, which is another song that I'm going to do here in a second. Poet Laureate took months and months and months after 9/11 to come out of me, and I edited it 16 or 17 times.
Wow.
But to me, it's an important song. But I also knew you can play it straight up, acoustic guitar. It sounds fine.
Yeah.
But it's when you do it as a band, it has a lot of power.
So you did kind of have that all in mind when you were writing them, it sounds
like.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, when I wrote Poet Laureate, I had a band at the time. You know, we had such a clever name, the James Curley Band. And, you know, I immediately began rehearsing the song in the band. So it's always had a full sort of arrangement. And it's a guitar. It's actually, there's a, you know, it's a guitar lick driven song. There's a signature lick in the opening and between the first couple verses that later goes away. But it's part of the... It's almost a lyric, and it's almost a sort of a wail or a cry about 9/11 in the lick itself. And so it's integrative, and it sounds best with a couple of guitars doing it. I don't get all wishbone ash with it, but, you know.
Do you feel like you write differently when you're writing for a band versus...
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
no question. You know, when I'm... Yes, because if I'm writing a song, I actually do a lot of writing at the piano.
Oh, really?
I would never play the piano in public.
Yeah.
Because I'm not... good at performing on the piano, but I can play the piano sufficiently to find adjacent chords and melody structures that are hard to find on the guitar because of the geometric construction of the guitar. And I love the guitar, and I love the acoustic guitar, and I particularly love my two Martins, but but I also notice the limitations of the fretboard in general, and I like to write on the piano. So much of Poet Laureate was written on the piano, so it has diminished chords in it and things like that. It opened with a guitar, like I finished writing the song on the piano. I wrote the bridge in the on a piano,
mm-hmm.
And then pulled it back together. And so actually quite a few of my songs have been written on the piano. And it's just because, I don't hear a song as a singer, strum writer, singer, songwriter thing. I hear songs as songs.
Right.
And if a song happens to work well, You know, I have a song coming out on this next record called On an Ordinary Day, which is about Iraq and Afghanistan. And when we did it for the record, it's just me and the guitar, one vocal, and a little bit of violin. It was perfect. It's kind of, you know, just right. And so there's no rhythm section there and no other instrumentation, and that works.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think songs. I think when a song is finished, one of the things it does is it tells you how it should be heard.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean it's the only way it should be heard.
Yeah.
But it tells you it needs to be heard in a certain way. Like a song like Radio Fade, which is also on this next record. Radio Fade I wrote out of feeling a great loss at the deaths of Johnny Cash, Rick Danko, Townes Van Zandt, and Warren Zevon, all in a relatively short time. And
right.
All tremendous influences on me at various points in my songwriter's career, because as I said, we were speaking before you turned on the mics, and I said, I go intensely into a songwriter for a period of time and then I never listen to him again. And so I went through a Johnny Cash phase. I went through a Warren Zevon phase. I went through a Townes Van Zandt phase when I was in Texas very distinctly.
Yeah.
And then Rick Danko, who was the bass player for the band. You know, all my life I've loved his voice and the songs he wrote in the band. You know, it makes no difference where I turn. You know. So those four guys died in a couple of months of each other, and I was just morose about that. It was like, and I'll be totally selfish about it. It's because I was feeling old.
Yeah.
I mean, my heroes were dying. Man, I was coming up. You know, my ticket's going to be punched relatively soon. Maybe it's 30 years, maybe it's 50 years, maybe tomorrow, but it's still, you know, mortality looming.
Feel that shifting of the seats. Huh?
So, you know, it was, that song came out of there, but I knew the minute I wrote it, it was a rocker. It was a band song. I mean, I can play it with just an acoustic guitar, but it's kind of like, you know, I once, years and years ago in Philadelphia, went to see Pete Townsend in the solo show, and he came out with just an Ovation acoustic guitar, and he was fabulous. I mean, you know, let's come on. He was Pete Townsend. You know, his right hand is a metronome and a machine gun all in one, and he was just, of course, great, and he was doing those songs that he didn't do with The Who, you know, There Once Was a Note, Pure and Easy Playing, all that great stuff that were Pete Townsend solo stuff. But at the end of the day, he did some Who songs, and as great as they were solo, they were not like they were with The Who.
Yeah.
And so it was like that kind of thing. So I feel like sometimes when I play a song like Radio Fade, it's like, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
But it ain't the way it should be, because it's written with more punch and more, you know, there's nothing like a rhythm section.
Yeah, the drums and the bass can really carry it more than just strumming the heck out of it.
Well, and I'm not much of a strummer.
Yeah.
I'm as Tom's Cafe, I fingerpicked, but even overall, I'm not much of a strummer. I actually don't like the sound of a lot of strummed guitars.
Mm-hmm.
I play more pianic style on the guitar.
Uh-huh.
And I like to hear notes and you know, think about it. Strumming is a lot of very, very, very fast arpeggios.
Right.
And but chords, which are sounded all at the same time, you know, that sounds different, or, you know, that sounds different than.
Right.
And I like the ability to pick out the notes. I like to do double stops and you know, four notes, like a diminished chord, you know, where you get the full effect of the diminished chord in real time, as opposed to the, you know, not that there's anything wrong with arpeggiation, but.
So how did you develop your finger-picking style on the guitar?
I don't know. I would say unconsciously.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that's not completely true. I've been enamored of certain guitarists. Now, I say guitarists specifically, not meaning songwriters.
Right.
Because a lot of songwriters are not great guitarists. A lot of them are, but, you know.
Right.
I was really enamored of Jorma Kaukonen, who was the guitarist in The Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna.
Yeah.
And then he had a solo record in 1977 called Qua, where it's just him. And I remember hearing it at, I don't know how old I would have been then, right? 57, 77. Yeah, so 20, 21 years old. I remember hearing it and thinking, he's got to be dubbing three guitars. And it turns out it was just Jorma sitting picking. And, you know, he did like Gary Davis stuff, like Light of This World, you know. Now, so I said to myself, I didn't know what it had nothing to do with songwriting. I just said to myself, I got to learn how to do that. So, you know, because that to me was more interesting than strumming.
Yeah.
And so I got enamored of him. And then over the years, David Bromberg as a guitarist. You know, Bromberg is not he's not known as a songwriter. He's got a few songs he's written, and some of them are hilarious and some of them are touching, but he's not generally known as a songwriter. He's known as a guitarist. Ralph McTell, who I went back and audited later in life again, having listened to him in my teens, another really, really good guitarist. And I'm not influenced very much as a songwriter by James Taylor, but I think I'm very much influenced by the way
style.
He plays guitar.
Yeah.
Because it's unique. And, then having lived in the Texas songwriter scene,
yeah,
there's a lot of that country blues emphasis in the Texas songwriter scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's all just came together. I used to practice, you know, country blues and those things to learn guitar, but sooner or later, those things all integrated into my songwriting organically. So I didn't set out to learn to write in a certain way.
Just kind of that stew. I know you talk about on your website you like stew.
Yeah,
so
I do like stews.
Your finger picking sounds like a bit of a stew. What's going to be your second song you're going to play for us?
I'm going to play Poet Laureate, which is the central song of this new record.
Great.
The title of the record is Manufactured Meaning, and you'll hear that in the lyric. And I seem to be a little out of tune on the bass end here, so there we go, a little sharp. The other thing about playing, you know, a good guitar as opposed to the guitars you can afford when you're 17 is you can hear it when it's out of tune. You
know? Yeah.
The guitar actually speaks to it, says, no, not yet. Which is, you know, I had some, you know, plywood harmony or something when I was 17.
Yeah.
Miles an hour, not quite the speed of sound. Two residential molotovs, 800 feet above the ground. Below the dragons over Dresden, when the firestorms touch down. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, their world-changing report, bore unwitting witness to that morning in New York. One more bastard testament to human handiwork. Where's our poet laureate? Where's our burnished bard? Who can manufacture meaning? Circumstance so hard. Who will weave together the blood and bone and tears into myths we tell our children that make hatreds disappear? A jingo junkie shakes a fist, swears jackals rule the day. Raging in a vain attempt to shout the pain away. As though the troubled heart finds comfort in cliché. A poised and perfect TV pundit wails and gnashes teeth. Offers hollow rhetoric, diminishing true grief, but can't explain how anyone could murder or believe. Where's our poet laureate? Where's our burnished bard? Who can manufacture meaning from circumstance so hard? Who will weave together blood and bone and tears into myths we tell our children that make hatreds disappear? The new Tower of Babel is a parabolic dish. without understanding. Information's meaningless. Where's our bold new bodhisattva? Where's our sinless saint? Who is willing to be crucified so we can get the hint? Where's our poet laureate? Where's our burnished bard? Who can manufacture meaning from circumstance so hard? Oh, where's our poet laureate? Where's our bird?
Very nice.
Thanks.
So that's going to be the kind of the centerpiece theme of the new CD?
Yeah, it's you know, the songs are all about, in one way or another, they're all about mortality or meaning or you know, just the way we bring ourselves to the world and have to try and understand things that, you know, by anybody's definition don't seem to make a hell of a lot of sense. You know, I think, you know, people talk about 9/11 in a way, oh, 9/11 changed everything. I don't really feel that way, but I do think it was quite shocking and one of those events that, you know, you struggle to make sense of, not unlike the events last week at Virginia Tech. I
mean, right.
They happen, and you can accept them in a Zen way and say, you know, life's hard, water's wet, your mother's your mother. But on the other hand, we do strive for meaning. You know, actually, one of the most influential books of my life was in high school. I had a teacher recommended me that I read a book called Man's Search for Meaning by a psychologist or psychiatrist, I can't remember which, named Viktor Frankl, who had been imprisoned by the Nazis in concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
And that book has affected me my entire life. Hmm. It's still to this day something that I think the difference between, you know, a good life and an awful life is a life in which we manufacture our own meaning.
Mm-hmm.
We make our lives have meaning because on the surface they just don't. You live, you die. It does seem absurd at some level. I mean, French existentialism goes part of the way.
Right.
And I think Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning went the rest of the way.
Right.
And I think the whole, you know, I was raised a Catholic and all that. I think you can understand all religion in that context.
Mm-hmm.
All religion is a struggle for meaning. So it takes different forms and it invents rules and various, you know, things that matter to people in a real way. I'm not denigrating them at all.
Right.
I just think it's all a function of
trying to add meaning to this existence.
Yeah, we're meaning machines.
Yeah,
I honestly
think we need that, right?
We do. I think I think without it, life is brutal and
meaningless.
Poor and meaningless. Yeah, literally. Let's not be redundant here, but yeah. So this record's about that. The next record will be a lot more fun.
Yeah.
The next record, I'll give a little hint here, is called American Folk Lure, L-U-R-E.
So you've already got it planned out?
I do have it planned out. I have all the songs for it already.
You've already got the songs written?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, great.
Yeah, I have a whole backlog of songs.
How many songs do you think you've written?
That I've kept?
Yeah.
Oh, 50 or 60 that I've kept.
Uh-huh.
And hundreds that I've thrown out.
Yeah.
Over the years. Some things just never make it.
Yeah.
They're stupid when you write them. You hang on to them out of attachment, and then later on you go, yeah, this is still stupid, and so you throw it out.
Yeah, throw it
but
away.
But they're all part of the process.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know what's bad, you can't notice what's good.
Right. You know. Do you have any kind of set ratio in your mind? I feel like if I write 10 songs, maybe I'll have one that's pretty good. And
no,
maybe I write 50, maybe I'll have one that's, you know, decent, you know, up there a little bit higher.
I've never noticed a ratio. I mean, my experience has been that when I take songwriting seriously, I write good songs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I don't take it seriously, I don't. I don't have a particular process. Generally, it starts with inspiration of some kind. And where that comes from is often very mysterious to me. I mean, the poet laureate thing, I honestly don't remember how it got started. But I had one line in my journal. I keep a journal. I have a little book here called Songs in Progress. And to give you some example of the kinds of things that are in it, there's an entire... on the front page is an entirely finished lyric called... The name of the song is A Towns Van Zandt Song.
Oh.
But I haven't finished writing the music to it, so I can't perform it because I don't do that.
So you can write, do you write lyrics without knowing the melody?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, earlier before the mics were on, we were chatting a little bit, and I talked about, you asked me to come up with my favorite songwriters or whatever, and I thought, yeah, well, how, you know, the default seemed to be in all the previous podcasts, singular songwriters,
sure,
which is actually sort of my nickname, by the way. If you've noticed my tag on MySpace, I've trademarked singular songwriter because I don't like singer-songwriter. But I thought, you know, I thought, what about all the great duos? You know, mm-hmm, Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hart, Elton John and Bernie Taupin,
yeah,
Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
And in many cases, I think if you look at or you read about the way these guys wrote songs, in many cases, the lyric and the music were being written separately.
Sure.
So one would come in with the lyric and say, this is what has to be said in this part of this Broadway show by the character.
Right.
And now the musician or the song, you know, the melodist or whatever you want to call that part of the songwriting team would have to then craft the melody and mm-hmm, the rhythm and everything else. And so I think it's not mysterious. If you're writing a song where you want the lyric to be important and to be recognized as opposed to just like, hey, nani, nani, or,
yeah,
you know, whatever, it's very likely that you can write the lyric and then find a good melody and a good rhythmic fit for it. The other way around seems a lot harder to me. Like, people have come to me and said, here's a piece of music, could you write a lyric to it?
Yeah.
I can't do that. I've tried on request, and it's like, to me, the ideas are all lyrical. And then lyric suggests rhythm.
Yeah.
I mean, poetry is rhythmic. The difference between poetry and prose is that poetry is rhythmic. And it's a rhythmic construction and always has been.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and much of my work, sometimes what I do when I can't tell whether or not I'm going to be able to write a melody to a lyric that I've written is I read the lyric as poetry and see if it stands up rhythmically as poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, then I know I can eventually find a melody.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then it's not going to work.
And do you sometimes, as you start getting into the melody and the rhythm part of it, do you sometimes tweak the words that were there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. Then it becomes more integrative. But
so it kind of iterates on itself. And
well, Jimmy Webb, in his book, Tunesmith, has a wonderful sort of section in the book where he talks about the metric feet of a song and fitting a lyric to the metric feet.
What does that mean, metric feet?
Oh, you never heard the term metric
no.
feet? You know, if you're writing a lyric that has four beats to the measure,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, it basically there are, so you could say that four beats is a metric foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want the line to be five metric feet, then there's going to be 20 quarter notes in that line. Now, that doesn't mean you're necessarily singing 20 quarter notes, but there's going to be 20 quarter notes. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So now what do you do inside that? Inside those metric feet, you have to fit the lyric. And if the lyric bunches up at the end of one of those metric feet,
yeah,
or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Then it's not going to work.
Right.
Nobody's going to like the song. It's not going to feel like a song. It's going to feel like something stupid. And so he just has a very simple sort of diagram of the way, you know, once you start writing a song, you're going to be, songs are highly repetitious, which is what makes them songs. It's why people like them. It's
right.
why people like to sing them.
Right.
So the repetitious part is actually very easy. It's metric feet. So once you figure out what the metric feet is, you know, 500 miles an hour, not quite the speed of sound, because I originally had more than half the speed of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Too many words. So not quite the speed of sound worked better.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is after I write the lyric and then I find the melody that I want and the rhythm that I want, then I go back and work the lyric into the metric feet, which is how I rewrote Tom's Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the lyrics didn't work inside the metric feet of the song that I was writing melodically and rhythmically. So I think songwriting is a craft that is capable of producing art, but not all songs are art.
Right.
And I think any songwriter who thinks every song they wrote is art is egotistical in the extreme. But it is capable of producing art, and I think if you work the craft and you work it hard, you know, you write your lyric and you know that it's not finished. So you don't sit there and say, this is a finished lyric, I will make the melody fit this lyric. That's stupid.
Right.
So you write the lyric, you get out what it is you want to say. And then you find the music that helps you say it. and then you rework the lyric to match that music. And I find that process, the back and forth of continuing to edit and doing those little tricks like taking out every preposition so that all you have left are verbs and nouns, I think that's a very good and clever way to decide whether or not you're saying more words, more syllables than you need to say. At the end of the day, metric feet are syllables inside beats. That's all they are. So you can write a song with no words. You could just sing na 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 na, and later on write the lyric to that.
Right.
But sooner or later, the two things have to sync up.
That's right.
You're not going to get away with one being out of sync with the other. And so the integrative nature of songwriting, I think, lends itself to that pretty well.
So do you usually come up with your ideas for songs? Do you have an idea of, I'd like a song that says this? Do you get like a line of the song, a bit of the melody and a line together?
Sometimes all of that.
Yeah.
It varies from song to song. I mean, songs come from weird places. I don't really know. I actually don't know where they come from. And I don't mean to sound the way like, ooh, songwriting's mysterious. Yeah. I don't mean that. But it's like, I mean, if I look back at some songs, I don't really know how they started. I don't recall when they started. I do know, like, for instance, sometimes I literally get an idea and I have to stop whatever I'm doing and write down the lyric, the line. I mean, I have snippets in my song notebook of things that I started writing that I never finished, but I know someday I may go back to them. And interestingly enough, I have a song which I'll play here in a minute, my third song, which is brand new. It's called There Used to Be a Train. I thought it'd be fun to play a new song. But that song, I didn't want to write a song about a train, didn't think about writing a song about a train. I'm a huge Steve Goodman fan, and certainly City of New Orleans probably lingers in my back of my head every day of my life.
Yeah.
But I didn't set out to write a song about a train. Oddly enough, I set out to write a song about Steve Goodman. And what happened was I started writing a song, which I'm still working on, called Goodman's Shoes. And I may or may not finish it for this next record. I hope I do, but it's not finished yet. And I started writing the chorus of that song and decided that the chorus was a little trite and it was too quotey of Steve Goodman's work, and so I didn't want to do that. So, but the original lyric said something like, I never rode the disappearing railroad when I had the chance. And then I thought, it's just crap. So I changed the disappearing railroad to rusted rails, which, you know, poetically says the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, if the rails are rusted, then obviously the railroad's disappearing.
Right.
And then I went and played at Uncommon Ground with a friend of mine named John Hasbrook. Actually, I was planning to play Uncommon Ground. Not yet. But I went to John's house and practiced. He had just bought a National Resophonic mandolin.
Oh, boy.
And John is a great, 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 great guitarist. But he wanted to play with his mandolin, and he's already quite good on it. And he said, come on over. We got to play, and you got to do songs that I can play the mandolin to. So we did. We went over, and I played some things, and went home that night thinking, God, I just want to write a song to play with John on the mandolin. And I knew this song wasn't it. But literally out of nowhere, this rusted rails, which I had just put in the lyric of this other song, kept running around in my head. And I came up with, the rusted rails and rotting ties are all that remain to prove that once upon a time there used to be a train. Boom, just fell out of my head that couplet completely. And then I thought, now I got to write a song. So those two words created that song. And then rhythmically, I knew it was a song that I wanted John to play mandolin to.
Yeah.
So it had to be, it had,
can't have a good upbeat rhythm.
Yes. So now I had the rhythm and I had a couplet.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, what do I want to say? Do I just want to say, oh, I miss trains? No, that's lame.
Yeah.
I want the train to be a metaphor for other things that are disappearing in the American experience and my life. And so I wrote the song. And really, the song's political. It's about, you know, what I think is... Now, I think everyone looks back on a time they didn't live in and think it was simpler.
Yeah.
And I have nostalgia for a period of life when I wasn't even born, which is the 40s. And I think New York in the 40s and train rides across the country and all that. I love that whole idea. Well, life was probably also complicated and a little cumbersome and, you know.
Yeah, I have a friend who always says, oh, yeah, back in the good old days when, you know, 50% of the people were illiterate and people lived to be 42 years old or whatever,
right.
You know.
Yes.
So he kind of pokes fun of it all the time in the good old days.
So that's what I'm talking about. But nonetheless, that kind of nostalgia is very appealing to people and appealing to me as a person. And I thought, well, can I take that nostalgia and can I say something about current American life. And so I worked the lyrics quite hard. And
yeah.
Decided I wanted to say something about trains themselves. So the first verse is just about the train. And I wanted to say something about my generation. So the second verse references Vietnam. And I wanted to say something about politics. And I wanted to say something about what I consider the vanishing morals of America. You know, we allow 44 million people to go without health care. And, you know, we think the homeless are a burden. And you know, so I wrote a verse about hobos, because hobos and trains...
yeah, they go together.
Go together. And then I wrote a song about trains and whistle-stop candidates, and I basically did a dig at our current occupant of the White House. Though, you know... And then I ended it saying, you know, I hope this isn't over. And so the song to me... I knew when this song was finished, because I just knew I would want to hear it if I was someone else.
Yeah.
And that may be the greatest testament to when you know the song is finished, because you think, if one of my favorite songwriters had written this, I would really like it.
Yeah, well, let's hear it.
Oh, all right. So...
There used to be a train, ran along these tracks, taking coal down to the plant, bringing empty rail cars back, headlight in the rain, blew its whistle in the night, rumbled through my dreams and told me everything's all right. There used to be a train, stopped in my hometown, took my cousin off to war, brought his body back around. He jumped from planes into the fields of Vietnam, but died in New York City with a needle in his arm. The rusted rails and rotting ties are all that remain to prove that once upon a time there used to be a train. There used to be a train. There used to be a train. Every hobo hitched a ride from job to job and town to town across the countryside. Now the fruited plain offers nothing for the poor, and honest work for homeless folk has become folklore. There used to be a train, it would bring the candidates to every town so folk could hear the whistle stop debate. Nowadays campaigns control every little thing, and we get the kind of president a train would never bring. The Roman Empire is no more, and we will fade away. Salaria, Great Northern, Santa Fe. There used to be a train, far off in the night, bound for the horizon. In the early morning light, the free and the brave would board it with their dreams. Well, I hope and pray that old train ain't running out of steam. The rusted rails and rotting ties are all that remain to prove that once upon a time there used to be a train. There used to be a train. Rusted rails and rotting ties are all that remain to prove that once upon a time there used to be a train. There used to be a train.
All right. Very good. I like that one. That's brand new, he said, huh?
It is. And it's, you know, you're talking about how you absorb your influences. I mean, I'm not a Bob Dylan influenced guy in a big way. I mean, everybody's heard Dylan, and I listened to him, and certainly went through periods listening to him. But, and I'm not a Woody Guthrie guy in the sense that I never listened to Woody Guthrie per se. I never got Woody Guthrie records and played them over and over the way I did other songwriters. But that song has Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie all over.
Oh yeah.
And so, to me, that's just part of the stew that you absorb in America. As growing up listening to this music, and you know, I don't generally write like that, but I wanted a piece that John could play mandolin to, and next thing I knew I had, I mean, I entered this in the Woody Guthrie Songwriting Festival this year.
Oh, good luck. I hope, I think you got a good shot. It's a great song.
We'll see. I mean, I've never entered a song in that festival before because it just didn't seem like I had anything appropriate, but then it was like, and it was too late to get off to Kerrville, but, I'll send it off to Kerrville next year and see what happens.
That had the fill. You know, let's take a quick break. I'm going to pause this, and we can come back and talk about your influences, just because we're running out of time here on the one side. Hold on one second. All right, James, let's talk a little bit about your influences for songwriters. If you were going to create a songwriter Hall of Fame, who would you induct into this thing?
Well, you know, you had asked me that in the email, and I wrote a short list, and as I wrote it, I realized there are single songwriters, and then there are duos, and I mentioned them earlier. So in the duo camp, I'd have to put Lieber and Stoll, or Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hart, Lennon McCartney, George and Ira Gershwin.
Yeah.
But in the solo, you know, I think that for me, the biggest influences were, as I mentioned early on, Ralph McTell, who really caught my ear. Harold Arlen, who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow and most of the songs for the Wizard of Oz, which I still consider one of the great, great, great pieces of American songwriting, front to back.
If I Only Had a Brain. That's a great melody in that, huh?
All of that. I mean, you know, so I think, you know, you can go back to the Tin Pan Alley and the early songwriters, and I think it'd be they're one after the other great, but I'll use Harold Arlen as my, you know, as my guy from that era, because I really think he wrote some of the best songs.
Yeah.
I'm a very big John Hiatt fan.
Yeah.
I wandered over to John Hiatt through listening to Ry Cooder, and then Ry Cooder was playing Slide on John Hiatt's early records, and who's this John Hiatt guy? And then right after I started to hear him, XRT picked him up, and then, you know, here in Chicago, WXRT became a huge, you know, place for John Hiatt, I think. And he actually even thanked XRT at the recent show at the Chicago Theater, where he said, "You guys don't know how lucky you are to have a radio station that still plays real music."
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just think John Hiatt is such a great, great American songwriter. Steve Goodman, out of Chicago here. You know,
good Chicago roots there.
When I moved here, I was worried that if I started playing around, I would actually sound too much like Steve Goodman and that people would think I was being imitative, so I didn't play much. And then when he died, which was, you know, just tragic, and I didn't know Steve, I didn't know his family, and I don't know anybody that knew him, but it was a big loss for me as a songwriter and a fan. And then I realized, going hanging around the Old Town School, that there were people there for whom it was a personal loss.
Yeah.
It was pretty interesting to me, and I think he was, you know, people talk a lot about Steve Goodman as a performer, and he was a fabulous performer. I saw him several times, both in Philly and in Texas, but he was also a great songwriter. John Prine, I mean, it's hard to say enough about John Prine.
Another Chicago rooted guy, right?
Yeah, John Prine from Maywood.
Yeah.
You know, when I first heard John Prine, I think the very first song I heard was "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore." And Dylan had been writing in a certain way, and, you know, Dylan had a tendency to write, you know, sort of biblical allusions and various kinds of, you know, almost over-the-top imagery, and here's John Prine just flat-out saying it.
Yeah.
And at the same time that I discovered John Prine, discovered Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
And a record called The Silver-Tongued Devil and I, which I still think is one of the best records ever made in Nashville. And a song there called The Pilgrim. I don't know if you ever heard
it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, I Kristofferson, people know him for Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night, but some of his other work is just brilliantly composed. Big Elvis Costello fan.
Oh, yeah?
I think, you know, Elvis Costello is one of the great users of unique melody and chord constructions in pop songwriting. And frankly, I don't even consider Elvis Costello pop.
Yeah.
The fact that he married Diana Krall is probably evidence of the fact that his music, and he's worked with Burt Bacharach.
Yeah, Burt Bacharach.
You know, who, by the way, should probably be on the list as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to add to the pair list, Elton John and Bernie Taupin. I know Elton John takes a lot of crap for being who he is and as a personality and stuff, but really, the first five or six records of Elton John and Bernie Taupin together were astonishing, great songwriting. I mean, I'm a big fan of an obscure record called Tumbleweed Connection, which never gets airplay anymore. The big hit, so to speak, from Tumbleweed Connection was a song called Burn Down the Mission.
Yeah.
But there were other little gems.
Is Mona Lisa in Manhattan's on that
one?
I don't know which one's that
No. Tumbleweed Connection was actually Elton John and Bernie Taupin's attempt at Americana.
Okay.
And what's funny about it is the song, have you ever saw the album, the original, you know, back when album covers were something, you know?
Does it have like a cowboy theme?
Yeah,
I've seen that.
Like old sepia-toned pictures.
Yeah.
And
it's like a saloon or something. Don't shoot the piano player or something.
No, that was
that's a different one.
Yeah, that's a different one as
okay.
well. No, this one looked like you know how the cover of Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash &
yeah.
Young has that sort of like they're standing with guns and it's like this 1860s
yeah.
instead of 1960s. Like
kind of Civil War picture
that's the
looking.
Feeling of Tumbleweed Connection.
Yeah.
And there are great songs on there. And then, of course, the, you know, Madman Across the Water, I think, is fabulous. I mean, it sounds trite or like, oh, pop music, what are you talking about? But I really think that's great melody and lyric writing.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Joni Mitchell. I think Joni Mitchell is astonishing in her ability to craft rhythms and alternate chord structures and melodies and still say things that are so evocative and so powerful. You know, and I mean, a lot of her songs are deeply personal about being a woman, and I don't have any direct experience of that in this lifetime, at least. But that doesn't matter because the songs are so good and so well written and so tremendous. Townes Van Zandt, I mentioned earlier, I went through in Texas a period where I was really very much listening to Townes. And, you know, the interesting thing about Townes to me is he was, you know, there's a magazine out now called Performing Songwriter, which I read and stuff.
Yeah.
And Townes was a performing songwriter, but at the end of the day, he didn't have a great voice.
Yeah.
He had a good voice, but not a great mm-hmm. voice. But it was unique, and it was evocative.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of honesty, I think, in
oh,
the performance,
yeah.
and I
yeah,
think
yeah.
that comes through better than sometimes a great voice or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, Bob Dylan's presence in American music gave permission for people like Townes Van Zandt. But in many ways, I consider Townes Van Zandt a better songwriter,
yeah.
more concise.
Well, Steve Earle would say that. I mean,
yeah,
I think,
that's right. Yeah, I know Steve Earle would say that. But And I like Steve Earle, too, by the way. But,
I do, too.
He's not a big influence on me.
Yeah.
But I like him a lot.
He supposedly has some quote that he says he would stand on Bob Dylan's coffee table and tell him that Townes Van Zandt's a better songwriter than him.
Well, you
In
know,
his cowboy boots or something.
Yeah. I mean, all of that's obviously highly subjective. And I think Dylan has incredible brilliance. But I also think it's too easy to say something like, oh, Bob Dylan's one of my big influences.
Yeah.
Because I think his work is pervasive throughout the culture, and so it's everyone's influence.
Right.
And so to sort of cite it as something that makes your work uniquely your own, I think, is probably not
right.
true. That's probably enough, I guess. I could go on. I talked about my influences as a guitarist, Jorma and David Bromberg and
yeah, really,
James
Taylor. I was happy to hear the ones that leapt to the top of your list, the pairs, Lerner and Lowe, which
yeah.
we were talking a little bit
yeah.
about earlier, two of my favorites,
yes.
as well as Rodgers and Hart.
Yeah.
I know when Terry was on, he was a bigger Rodgers and Hammerstein fan.
Rodgers
but I think Rodgers and Hart, I like them a little bit
yeah,
better.
Yeah, I think you got me there, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of that American musical theater, I mean, people sometimes lose. My daughter's 17, and she's a musician, and she's going to maybe even major in musical theater. And we talk a lot about this kind of stuff. And I talked to her about, you know, she was trying to figure out what made the Beatles unique. And I said, most great music is the confluence of a couple of musics crashing into each other.
Right.
And so for me, the Beatles took, you know, what Elvis was doing and what Little Richard was doing, which was American rock and roll rhythm and blues, and it collided with British show hall music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get old and
yeah.
blues. And you, I mean, that's British show hall music. and the Kinks, by the way, very much influenced by British show hall music. I mean, actually, the Kinks actually have a song, Come Dancing.
Yeah, right.
You know, which is one a great, perfect version of that kind of thing. I think, you know, much of what's considered great American folk music was, again, a collision of Appalachia with the recording industry and with American rock and roll and with musical theater. And so
Yeah, Lieber and Stroller, they were, you know, for writing for a lot of shows and stuff,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly right. And, you know, Jimmy Webb, who I should cite as well, not only as the author of Tunesmith, which I think, as again I'll say, is the Bible of songwriting. Even if you don't want to write like Jimmy Webb, which I don't,
right?
It doesn't matter. The craft of songwriting is so beautifully exposed in that book in a way that anyone who's writing can take it and add something to their repertoire in terms of craft skills.
Mm-hmm.
But also just some of the stories he talks about, how songs come from, where they come from, and how the inspiration for a lyric is almost never the finished lyric,
mm-hmm.
because you have to then marry it with this other thing, this metric, time-constrained...
It's like marinating rhythmic. It or yeah, something.
There's something magical about putting words to music that is different than just writing words or just writing music.
Yeah.
And that's enough, I guess. Huh? I'm not sure how much...
So how much... your influences, how much of those do you think are present in your songs? When you take a step back and look at your songs, do you see bits and pieces or snippets of, hey, that's a little bit of Bob Dylan, or that's a little bit of Towns, or that's a little bit of Steve Goodman? Or
I think like any, I mean, all, every songwriter I know is referencing their influences.
Yeah.
There's no way around. Every artist is referencing their influences. Every painter, every photographer, everybody is basically building on the shoulders of, or standing on the shoulders of a lot of people who came before them. So I think what the difference between being 17 and writing imitatively,
yeah,
and being 50 now and writing authentically is that somehow through the process of honoring your influences but not copying them,
yeah,
they show up on the edge of your work as, you know, guardian angels on the shoulder of the song. And so there may be the occasional twist of lyric or melody that comes right out of one of your influences. But for the most part, they really have, for me, I mean, my joke about stews, they really are a stew.
Yeah.
You know, I have songs where I hear multiple influences all at once.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't mention Jackson Browne, by the way, but Jackson Browne, because I went through a really deeply intense period of listening to Jackson Browne and loving him, and then went years from not listening to him, and then recently bought his record that he put out last year or 2 years ago and rekindled my relationship with Jackson Browne. So I think, you know, and he's matured.
Yeah.
And he doesn't sound like the Jackson Browne of the 70s, you know, and it's great to, I mean, it's nice just to see everybody evolving. And American songwriting is, I think, in a great, great place. I mean, you know, there's almost too much. I mean, you go to the internet, and every day I discover other songwriters who are gifted and talented and unknown. And, you know, the fact that the record industry is unraveling, we don't know what it's going to look like next.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of great stuff out there and a lot of stuff finding audiences.
Well, now, where do you go to find these songwriters? Do you just, you know, look around in MySpace, or are you reading articles here and following the link? Or, you know, where would you recommend somebody go to find some new songwriters?
I think one of the best places is Performing Songwriter Magazine.
Performing Songwriter Magazine.
For a number of reasons. One is Performing Songwriter Magazine is a great publication. And I think if you're not a songwriter, reading it is even more fun, probably.
Yeah.
Because many times I read Performing Songwriter and I'm jealous that I'm not in it. That may color the way I read the article. But I just read an article, an interview with Iggy Pop, and it was fabulous. And, you know, for some reason I always thought was English, and turns out he's from Michigan and lives in Florida.
He's from Detroit or something,
isn't
he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I guess because David Bowie took him under his wing, I thought he was English. But long story short, Performing Songwriter is really two magazines. It's a magazine that really explores the good, published, popular, very successful performing songwriters who are well known by various genres of American listeners. And then the second part of it is the DIY, the do-it-yourself ethic, where they review lots and lots of self-published CDs and give them pretty thorough reviews and then tell you what they think are the best of them. And I have rarely gone wrong. You know, unless it's a genre of music that I just don't listen to or don't have a real affinity for, like hip hop,
right,
or something, which I respect but don't have any affinity for personally.
Right.
I've rarely gone wrong by listening to the people that Performing Songwriter Magazine says you got to hear this. And so, I mean, in MySpace, I doodle around a lot because I have you know, I have a lot of MySpace activity. I have a lot of friends, and I have 26,000 listens. And
that's great.
Growing every day, which is interesting. I mean, I've done a little bit of, you know, clicking around and trying to market myself, but it's really amazing how sooner or later you realize other people are telling people about you.
That's great. Good feeling, huh?
Yeah, it's weird and good, and it's interesting. It's like, you know, really, it's I think it's the 21st century version of radio.
Yeah.
You know, it's radio. It's a type of radio.
You're more control. You get to pick what you want, when you want it.
And you're your own DJ. And I have clicked on the websites of the MySpace pages of some astounding unknown songwriters.
Yeah.
And I've also listened to a lot of Drek.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Because, you know, I think, you know, Drek is interesting. And, you know, I mean, I think anybody who's working at it deserves to be listened to to some degree. I think the only thing that ever drives me crazy is when people are putting out Drek and they really are telling you it's the best thing you ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, you need an independent voice. I mean, when I put out my first record, it was reviewed and a lot of people liked it and some people didn't like it. And the criticisms that were made of the record, I actually learned from and made sure that my second record didn't have those things.
Is it tough when you get criticism?
No, I'm married 28 years.
You're used to it.
there's nothing that a music critic could say that even
they haven't already heard. Yeah,
I mean, there's no tougher critic than my wife, and she loves me dearly. But I'll play a song for. She's the only person, by the way, that I will play songs for that are unfinished.
Yeah,
because she's not a musician, but she's a great set of ears. She knows good music and grew up, you know, listening to good music and has great taste in music. And being not a musician, she's an audience. And, you know, there's nothing that songwriters crave more than an audience.
Right.
But in her case, I know that she'll look at me and say, it ain't working.
Yeah.
Now, she can't articulate from a craft standpoint why it's not working. Doesn't matter. To me, it's enough to know that it's not working.
Right.
And then I'll go back and work it until it is working, until she says, oh, I like that. So that's great to have that foil.
For, yeah. You know. It's nice if people are willing to give you the honest feedback, too. You know, sometimes people love everything you do. Sometimes people hate everything you do. It's nice to get an honest, balanced picture, right?
Yeah. Well, it's. I don't want anybody to love everything I do.
I think some people are just too polite to say. You know, I don't. I play a song for my mom, and you know, she loves everything I do.
Well, she's
like, yeah, exactly. So then you wonder, well, okay, if she's the only one who's liking it, then maybe it's not that good.
Well, I think, you know, your peers are your best critics. You know, I really wish I could get to the songwriter circle at Old Town more, because I think that's a great group of peers. And there are people operating at all kinds of levels in there, including very accomplished and just starting out. And the support level in there for a young songwriter, you know, to hear commentary, you know. But first of all, if you open that door and walk in that room, if you're not open to criticism, you shouldn't open the door and walk in the room.
That's right.
So you're saying, you know, I'm an artist in process and willing to hear criticism.
Right.
But I think everybody who goes there gets better.
I think so, too. And I think you're right. I think there is a big range in. That's one of the things that appealed to me there is, you know, I've probably somewhere in the middle, which is great for me because, you know, you don't want to be the worst one and you probably don't want to be the best one either. And
I do.
Yeah, I probably would, actually.
Of course, I was first in my class in grade
school. But it's not, I mean, I think it's a healthy place for people to go and learn and you can aspire to get better there and stuff. So.
I love the different styles. I mean, that's what I find, you know, I mean, again, it's called the Old Town School of Folk Music, but there are people in there that are not writing folk music, and that's what I like.
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's the limits on there.
It's just American songwriting.
Which is good, yeah. Well, do you have a final song you'd like to play for us?
I do. This is a song called it's called This Local Story. And, you know, a lot of my images and songs are about the media.
Mm-hmm.
I think we consume media so voraciously in this country, and that it's literally the sea in which we swim for information. And I, you know, so I have a song called TV or Not TV.
I saw that on there. That's funny.
Which
is that a play on the Shakespeare?
It
to
is,
be or
it
not
is,
to be?
Actually
yeah.
Is, yeah.
That's great.
And you know, Poet Laureate mentions a poised and perfect TV pundit wails and gnashes teeth. And I'm fascinated by the sort of incestuous and bizarre relationship we have with media. And so this song it's called This Local Story. And it's basically about the kinds of stories that are missed by the media. Thank you.
in the broadcast time that falls between the tavern door and dawn. Blue flickers through a blind reveal a man drinking alone. He pours a glass of memory loss, his fingers graze a rotary phone. The feeble radiation that emanates from a disappointed heart leaks through drafty windows and silently disappears. The crackle and the bristle of confusing and angry turns of thought mingle with the airwaves, making sounds no one can hear. Cinders of relationship that wax and wane with every labored breath. Smoldering in memory before being doused in Johnny Walker Red. Only to solidify as embers of doubt and dread. The feeble radiation that emanates from a disappointed heart leaks through drafty windows and silently disappears. The crackle and the bristle of confusing and angry turns of thought mingle with the airwaves, making sounds no one can hear. Boards replace the windows, barbed wire on the walls, solid steel fills doorways, brickwork fills the halls. Stillness violated by intruders who mouth the early news. Good morning, America. It's time for us to give you all your views. First, this local story, isolated loner killed by blues.
All right.
Thanks.
Very nice.
A little depressing.
Well, James, thank you very much.
Steve, thanks a lot.
Let's talk about, before we wrap up here, how could somebody who wanted to get your CD or hear some more of your music or see you play live, what can they do to find out more about your music?
My basic website is jamescurley.net. So that's C-U-R-L-E-Y, for those of you who spell Curly the way the Three Stooges do. I also have a MySpace site, which is MySpace/James F. Curley, F for Francis. And generally speaking, my gigs will be posted on the MySpace site. And my other site is primarily just basic information about the records. The new record won't be out for a bit. My old record's available on CD Baby. And mm-hmm. It's cdbaby.com/JF Curley, because that's the way CD Baby made me write it. And that's pretty much it. I mean, everything's pretty much web-based these days. So
great.
Figure if you can't get to the web, you're...
Makes it easy to get a hold of you, though, if we can find your website, right?
Yeah, and then my email links are all available there.
Okay,
and,
great.
You know, I welcome anybody.
That sounds great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a great 90 minutes here or so, and I really enjoyed talking to you. And
same here, Steve.
I appreciate you coming in.
I do too. I think it's great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.